content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Kogal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Do You Know What Day Tomorrow Is? And from Glamour Magazine. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached by kiwanisfoundation.org. Well, welcome back, everyone, to the new year, 2018, January 4th. Happy New Year. Hope you had a great time, whether you were relaxing or partying or whatever, and you have some ideas of what you might want to do new this year. It's a brand new year to start anything you want. And remember, mistakes are okay. Shows you're doing something, trying things. All right, we're going to start off. Where in the world did we get the name January anyway? All right, and this is from the Do You Know What Day Tomorrow Is book. The first month receives its name from the Latin Januarius, which was derived from Janua, meaning door. The word came from the name of the god Janus, who ancient Romans believed opened the gates of heaven to release daylight and close them when dusk arrived. The god also looked both to the past and to the future. And if your birthday happens to be in January, your flower is carnation and your birthstone garnet. All right, we have some pretty important people that were born January 1st. January 1st, 1735, birth of Paul Revere. Paul Revere helped to establish colonial independence from Great Britain. He took part in the Boston Tea Party and made his famous ride to warn the Patriots that the British troops were coming on April 18, 1775. Although best remembered for his patriotism, Revere was also an engraver and a master silversmith. He designed the first continental money and official seal of the colonies, and his Revere Bowl designs are still in demand today. They're the silver ones with a nice round footing and or base, and they're often engraved. They use them a lot for silver gifts. All right, January 1st, 1752, birth date of Betsy Ross. It is said that Betsy Ross made the first hand-sewn flag for the Continental Congress in 1777 at her home in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The flag was formally adopted by the Congress on June 14, 1777, which became Flag Day. Except for the addition of several stars and the rearrangement of stars and stripes, today's American flag remains essentially the same as the original. Then, January 1st, 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. This document was conceived as a military expedient rather than as a moral declaration ending slavery. 6 months prior to issuing the proclamation, President Abraham Lincoln warned the rebelling states that such an act was forthcoming. As commander-in-chief, the president was fearful of the military use the South could make of its slave manpower. The Emancipation Proclamation freed only slaves held in seceded states. Nevertheless, it set the stage for the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which outlawed slavery in the entire United States. Abolitionists, including the black leader Frederick Douglass, hailed the proclamation as an historic step in the fight for freedom. And on January 3rd, 1892, John Ronald Reuel Tolkien was born. J.R.R. Tolkien was born in Bloemfontein, South Africa, and brought to England at the age of 4. He acquired fame with his epic trilogy, The Lord of Rings. While working on the trilogy, he wrote The Hobbit, which serves as an introduction to the works. The character Bilbo Baggins is synonymous with fantasy. And on January 4th, today, in 1809, Louis Braille was born. Louis Braille was born in a village near Paris, France. So I guess we should call him Louis Braille. At the age of 3, due to an accident in his father's workshop, he was blinded. 17 years later, he published a system of printing and writing for the blind, which he had adapted from the night writing system used by Charles Barbier, a French army captain. Soldiers sent messages at night by punching coded dots on thick paper. The Braille system employs raised dots representing letters, signs, and numbers. It is still used by the visually impaired today. Braille died on January 16, 1852. On the door of the house where he was born are these words: "He opened the doors of knowledge to all those who cannot see." All right, we're going to start off with a comic strip. It is a little graphic story, like a cartoon, in the December issue of Glamour magazine. And it is called "Too Heroic to Hold Back." This year, director Patty Jenkins made Hollywood history with a little movie called Wonder Woman. We now present this real-life superhero's origin story, and it is written and illustrated by Emmy Viacelli. And here is how it starts. There's a girl holding a little bear, stuffed animal, and there's cows around, a little church, and a little house, and mountains in the background, green pastoral land. And she and her mom are standing on grass there. And the little girl looks up and says, "That's Daddy! There goes Daddy on the plane! Whoosh!" The daughter of an Air Force captain and a scientist, our heroine, Patty Jenkins, spends her childhood around the world. First, the family lives in Thailand and Germany. Then in Kansas, where Patty's parents settle when she's in kindergarten. One fateful snowy day, the car breaks down, and Mom and Dad send Patty to see Superman. "It had such a profound effect on me, emotionally," she said. And going back for a second about her dad being up in the plane, Dad was a fighter pilot. He was a dramatic figure in great outfits doing these epic things. When Patty is 7, her father passes away. She promises from that moment on to protect her mom and sister. "We were in a house with no man. I became ready to defend us." The sense of duty soothes her, but she worries that her personality is too big, too epic. A new chapter begins as an art student at New York City's Cooper Union. Patty waits tables at a local college hangout, and her undercover hero has a sidekick. Chauncey, a rescue pit bull, accompanies Patty everywhere. In fact, in this picture, she's got him in her smock, kind of like a baby's, you know, little snuggly. Patty knows she looks intimidating, and that's the point. And she's got this look on her face like, "Don't mess with me." Her hair is parted on the side and hangs long on one side and is short on the other side. And the people around her are saying, "Oh my God, cute." And then the other one says, "But weird." And let's see. After graduating, Patty finds work as a camera person but wants to direct. She moves to L.A. to attend the American Film Institute. Chauncey comes too, her doc. But at 30, despite directing Velocity Rules, a short film about a female superhero, she's in debt and struggling. She's in L.A. It feels like rock bottom. Patty considers writing a straight-to-video slasher film about serial killer Aileen Wuornos for $5,000. But something urges her. There is a better way to tell this story. She walks away. This is a real person's life, and I don't feel comfortable doing something that could be exploitative if I'm not in control, she says. And people around her, she's at a table, and she's holding her head, and she's got her head bowed, and she's looking down like she's got a headache, like, stop telling me things. She's, you know, got her hands up by her ears, and people around her are saying, get paid, do it, get paid. Good thing she holds out, because when she goes on to write and direct Monster with an unrecognizable Charlize Theron as Wuornos, it's a hit. Theron takes home an Oscar. And with that win, Patty starts to trust the voice inside her head. Other doors are opening too. At 36, Patty marries writer Sam Sheridan. Together, they have a son, Asa. All the while, Patty, who directs TV plots, observes her own story from the outside. She hasn't decided what comes next. More than a decade after Monster, she feels her power stirring. She has an idea for Wonder Woman, and it is big. After all, Diana is a girl, no, a woman with power and desires and fears. The studio passes, but again, Patty doesn't waver on her vision. I only want to do certain things, to make great films. And other people are saying, a Wonder Woman with confidence issues? Not for us. It'll cost too much. And 8 months later, the same studio circles back. Boom! Patty's on a plane to England to make the movie the next day. And something magical occurs to our heroine. Could my movie matter to someone the way Superman mattered to me? So did the film make an impact? Whoosh! Just a bit. She's on this airplane heading towards England. Jenkins becomes first woman to direct a Marvel or DC movie, and only the second female director to command a budget of more than $100 million. These are all the top lines of newspapers. Wonder Woman has the best box office debut ever for a film directed by a woman. It makes $103.1 million in its opening weekend. Jenkins on board for Wonder Woman sequel. Girls and boys everywhere are inspired by powerful, but kind Diana of Themyscira, played by Gal Gadot. I want to change out of my uniform and wear Wonder Woman armor. I want to be ready if I need to save the world, says a girl in a uniform. I want to speak hundreds of languages like Diana, says a boy reading. And call me Wonder Woman or I won't listen, says another one. Even Richard Donner, the guy who directed Superman, is so in awe of Patty that he passes a baton to her in front of the Directors Guild of America. It's a big moment. For him, the man who directed Superman to pass the baton to me was the greatest honor. I went from feeling powerless to making a film that inspired people to be braver. I wonder how far I can go. Well, asking how far someone can go leads me to our next story. And this is about Peggy Whitson. On top of the world, NASA's Whitson in her favorite place, the International Space Station, looking at the Earth. It's the most incredible view ever, she says. Peggy Whitson is heavy, or more precisely, very, very, very heavy, as she puts it when I ask how it feels to be home. This is hardly your average did-you-have-a-good-trip chat. Whitson has been traveling for 288 days, not around the world, not even to the ends of the earth, but off the planet entirely, in orbit, to be exact, and she's not so happy to be home. After floating for 9.5 months in space, gravity is not your friend, the astronaut says with a laugh. Send me back. For now, she'll have to enjoy the pizza and flush toilets, two of the things she did miss in space. Trust me, you don't want to know the details, she says. And rest on her laurels, which are many. Known for being exacting, hardworking, and infectiously positive, Whitson has blasted through records with abandon. Most spacewalks by a female astronaut, 10. At 57, the oldest woman in orbit. Not a goal I was ever shooting for, she jokes. First female chief of NASA's astronaut office. First woman to command the International Space Station. She's done it twice. And with her latest mission, which touched down in September, she has set a new record. 665 cumulative days in space. More than any American astronaut, male or female, young or old. As a science geek who has interviewed trailblazing women in STEM, even I am awestruck. How would you describe your bio? I ask her. She pauses. Peggy Whitson, astronaut. Extreme modesty is something else she's known for. There was a time when Whitson never imagined she'd be able to say those words. As a 9-year-old on a farm outside Beaconsfield, Iowa, she was spellbound by Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong as they walked on the moon. But her dream of being up there with them only became a tangible goal in 1978, the year NASA accepted its first class of female astronauts. Luckily, I had no idea how hard it would be to get selected, she says. Whitson had just graduated from high school, but she set her sights on NASA, eventually earning a PhD in biochemistry and landing a position at the space agency as a research associate in 1986. She immediately applied to the astronaut program and got rejected. So she applied again and again. Every time there was a class. It took 10 years and 5 attempts before she finally got the nod to show up for training. Even then, it wasn't until 2002 that she got to lift off on the Shuttle Endeavour for a 6-month stay on the International Space Station. The first time I went into space was just so much more than you could ever imagine or prepare yourself for, she says. Zero gravity is such an alien environment, completely different from everything we've grown up with every single day of our lives. And it's incomprehensible how much better it was than I anticipated it would be. Even more mind-blowing was her first spacewalk, or EVA, EVA in NASA lingo, for extravehicular activity. It may look as if astronauts are floating as easily as helium balloons, but EVAs are actually the most physically demanding task they face, since they must use massive upper body strength to walk by climbing hand over hand and operate tools through bulky pressurized space suit gloves. Whitson, by the way, has the most impressive arms I have ever seen, thanks to 2 hours of resistance training a day. After one of Peggy's workouts, astronaut Anne McLean, 38, told me, "Everybody is just lying on the floor, smoked." It's partly why her colleagues call her the American Space Ninja. The work is worth it, Walking in space is absolutely the most exhilarating part of a mission, says Whitson. The view is just incredible. Being out there above the Earth, I always think how delicate it looks. It gives me a fantastic appreciation of how this planet is one, and we need to take care of it. The thrill of that view never fades, nor does, she insists, the joy of living for months at a time on the space station with 2 to 5 other crew members, in her case all male, on a limited prepackaged diet. To boost team spirit on her various missions, Whitson did things like host Friday night movies, Passengers, Life, Star Trek, you get the theme, and request space burgers to be sent in her regular care package from NASA. Though they still have to be dehydrated to make the trip. It's all about the sauce, she explains. Her fellow astronauts are like family to her, but that doesn't begin to capture how intensely the crew relies on one another to carry out incredibly complex and dangerous work. On a 6-month mission, it's not if you make a mistake, it's how you handle it, she says. What did you learn from it? How do you communicate it so other people won't make the same mistake? How can you use it to make yourself or your team better? Most of all, Whitson loves the science she does on each mission. On this latest stay at the space station, she grew different types of stem cells in zero gravity, an experiment that could lead to cancer therapies, and studied how fuels burn in space to one day enable trips to Mars. Not the least exciting was getting to eat some of the Chinese cabbage crop she harvested with the goal of learning how to cultivate food on other planets. Landing on Earth this fall, Whitson finally got to reunite with her husband of 28 years, Clarence F. Sams, a NASA scientist in Houston. Still, her homecoming has been bittersweet. She will probably never command another space flight. Without the Earth's protective atmosphere, astronauts are exposed to higher levels of cancer-causing radiation, and Whitson has likely reached her safe limit. But if she can't go back into orbit, she is passionate about sending other women up. Peggy makes you feel like you can do anything, says McLean, who was in the 2013 astronaut class Whitson helped select. When she first came into the astronaut office, gender was a big part of the conversation. When I walked in, I was just expected to perform like anybody else. She took that gender conversation off the table. It's a fantastic legacy. Astronaut Sonita Williams, who has also commanded an expedition, agrees. Peggy is the leader of the space station. She's respected by the space agencies all over the world. She's the go-to person in an emergency, she says. That opens the door for people to realize women can lead. We can make critical decisions. We can take command. Roger that. Her words to live by? The biggest part of my success has been working hard. There's a quote from Illusions by Richard Bach that I've always remembered. You are never given a wish without also being given the power to make it true. You may have to work for it, however. Jillian Jacobs stars in Netflix's Love and directed the documentary The Queen of Code, and she is the author of this interview with Peggy Whitson. And we have a very short article on Mazoon Al-Melhan, the girl crusader, one of the women of the year. As soon as I started to use my voice, I found it was powerful. My campaign drew attention from organizations like UNICEF. They started to help me reach even more people. In April, I traveled to Chad, where so many girls are missing out on an education because of conflict with a terrorist group, Boko Haram. Since then, I've spoken at the United Nations General Assembly and the G20 Summit to carry those children's messages to world leaders and change makers. After nearly 3 years in refugee camps, my family resettled in Newcastle, England, where I've been able to continue my education. I'm applying to university for the 2018 school year and hope to study political science and international relations. When people started calling me the Malala of Syria, I was so proud. And then when I actually met her, she is remarkable. We shared our stories, our souls, and our goals as education advocates, and we became really good friends. It's wonderful to use my voice with Malala's to fight for girls. With all our voices, we can make a difference. Not just a small one. We can make a huge difference. We can change the world. And Mazun Al-Melahan's words to live by, quote, "Look how much you have been through. And you're still standing. You are much stronger than you think." And you can join Al-Melahan in helping every girl get an education by donating to Glamour's The Girl Project at thegirlproject.com. Maggie Mertens is a writer in Seattle, and she's the one who brought us this little quick biography of Mazun Al-Melahan, the girl crusader. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Kogal, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached by kiwanisfoundation.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Have a great week. See you next week.